a grain of wheat falls into the earth and dies, it remains a single grain. But if it dies, it bears much fruit. Now, for many of us, our first memory of a science project in elementary school is planting a seed in a Dixie cup, right? And then putting it up on the windowsill, and then for the next weeks, we watered it, we made sure it got enough sun, and mostly we just kept going and looking and praying and waiting and waiting and waiting. And when that first green shoot appeared, I mean, shooting up out of just inches of dirt. Well, I mean, we glorified ourselves as first-rate farmers, right? Now, I should mention at this point that although my name, George, comes from the Greek yorgos, meaning farmer, I am a city kid who knows just about as much about farming as you can fit in a Dixie cup. Really. So you have to work with me here. There's a lesson in all of this, though, that our elders wanted to teach us. But we never really get it, do we? Because we resist the idea that it must be so. That if you want a plant or a flower to grow, something has to die out of sight before that can happen. And we resist it not just because of that, but because we know it's also true for us. And we have a death grip on life, don't we? Jesus says that if we love our life too much and refuse to let it go, the change that is built into the nature of nature will get us anyway. Right? There's no life without death. There's no gain without loss. And we have so many ways to learn this beyond reading a passage like this in the Bible or studying a Dixie cup to try to see the truth of it. Just look at your own body. Our bodies bear witness that you have to lose your life to keep it. The life you now have is in some ways the life you've always had, and in some ways it is an altogether different life than you've ever had. Now think about this. There's a dynamic cellular process underway within you at every moment of every day. Your life code, the DNA that bears the unique signature of your life, is built into every cell of your body, and there are about 100 trillion of them, give or take tens of millions, right? And every cell contains about 0.35 gigabytes of data. That means that you are a massive storehouse of information. But your cells are refreshing themselves all the time. That is, they are reproducing themselves constantly. They are replicating themselves as precisely as possible. And when they make themselves old over, the old cells have to die away and give way to the new cells. It takes about 7 years for you to become an altogether new you. Which means I am in my seventh life already. This cat's got 2 more lives to go. The Greek philosopher Euripides said, all is change, all yields its place and goes. And Socrates added, nothing ever is, but all things are becoming. Life can't be life in the next instant if you try to make it the same as it was. We should pause on that one. Let me say it again. Life can't be life in the next instant if you try to make it the same as it was. That strategy is futile. But the good news is that the life that is coming to be can be more. The gospel Jesus brings to you and me today and every day is that the future belongs to God. The end is more than the beginning. God is fully glorified at the last, and so we can relax about the idea that change is destroying us. We can learn to accept change as the means of growth in us and of God's glory. In fact, if we would only learn to embrace it as Jesus did, we can glorify God in our lives and find ourselves remade with Christ. And this is what I'm calling redeeming loss. And of course, there are two ways of understanding that phrase, redeeming loss, right? And the first is that God redeems us through loss. And the cross is, of course, exhibit A of how that is true. But the other side of it is that we ourselves have to engage in a process of redeeming loss if we are to experience the life that is only possible when we do. For understandable reasons, we resist this. When loss occurs, we tend to focus only on what no longer is, instead of what is coming to be. And Jesus wants to redirect our gaze to that which is now possible for us. So here's the story John tells. Some Greeks came to the Passover festival in Jerusalem. This is an important distinction. This prompts Jesus to see that his hour has finally come, that the moment of truth has finally arrived. The leaders of the house of Israel, the religious establishment of the Jews, has rejected him. Read loss. But the fact that some non-Jews have been drawn to Israel by being drawn to him is a sign to Jesus that God's work in and through Israel is coming to a dramatic, if not traumatic, climax. Now read redeeming loss. He sees in his own impending death, as the loss of Israel's exclusive claim on God's favor, and at the very same time as the gain of Israel being opened up to the whole world and being included. That is, all of God's promises to Israel about what God is up to in the world, about what God is bringing to pass in a new age that is coming to be, of how God is going to redeem all things and all people. This now is not only Israel's hope, it is now the hope of all people. And it only comes to pass because of the simultaneous rejection and acceptance of Israel through Jesus. It took Jesus' loss to be our gain. You and I get included in this because Jesus is rejected on the cross and we then are accepted too. It's so ironic, isn't it, the way this happens? But the inclusion of the Gentiles as the people of God would not have happened if it were not for the exclusion of Jesus by his own people. If I am lifted up, Jesus says, in speaking about the cross on which he would die, I will draw all people to myself. So Jesus' loss is our gain. His single life is lost in order for it to become a new shared life that includes all people and all kinds of people, Jews and Gentiles alike. Israel remains Israel with all of her history and glory, but now she is open to a new shared experience of all who would glorify God with her. So here's the hard truth. Like Jesus, we must finally be willing to suffer loss faithfully if we are to experience the surprising faithfulness of God's redeeming loss. At the same time Jesus faced his final and finest hour, he could only see loss and death. But he put his faith in God to make more of his life through his death, not less. And the voice from heaven confirmed Jesus' faith and challenged all those around him to follow the way of Jesus. This Jesus way forces us to see possibilities in our losses and to offer them to God to make something more of them in us. The poet and novelist Wendell Berry writes, "A long time after we are dead, the lives our lives prepare will live here." His poem goes into all the ways the lives that come after us will be better than the life that we even lived ourselves if we have given ourselves to this vision. And then he concludes, "This is no paradisal dream. Its hardship is its possibility. Its hardship is its possibility." Now, that's a Lenten statement if you've ever heard one. But of course, that's the problem for us, isn't it? It's the reason so many of us do not follow Jesus and learn this wisdom, because it is easier for us to wallow in our losses rather than to see them turn into something beautiful. It's like the man who told his pastor why he doesn't like the season of Lent, Tim. It's because he said, "Pastor, I'm just not that into suffering." Right, which is why he can't learn the redeeming power of loss. In the movie Mr. Holland's Opus, Richard Dreyfuss, you know, plays Mr. Holland, and he struggles to adapt to a life that is not the one he wanted. He dreamed of becoming a great composer. But then a baby came along, and there were expenses. And so he found a job teaching music, and he would compose music in his spare time, but one challenge after another stripped him of his dream and forced him into things like teaching driver's ed, you know, struggling to tend to his deaf son who would never hear his music. He was forced to make the choice between his students and his dream symphony. But while it looked like the students kept winning over the symphony, what we learn in this story was happening all the while is that the independent composer slowly dies to the teacher who is inadvertently composing. The much fruit he bore becomes clear in the finale after many years of teaching young people. His opus, it turns out, his great life work, is a symphony composed of the lives that he encouraged and nurtured through his teaching. Nobody gets the life they expected. Nobody. And no church does either. But that doesn't mean it will be worse. It will just be different. When a grain of wheat falls into the earth and dies, it surrenders to that new life that bears much fruit. We have a dear friend in Dallas, Sheila Connor, who some years ago got that horrible news from the doctor that she had breast cancer. And she went through all the expected losses that come from that diagnosis. Sheila had a decision to make, and that is she could have dwelt upon and grieved what was lost, and everyone would have understood. But I watched her redeem her loss by becoming available to one woman after another who received the same diagnosis. I can't tell you how many times I picked up the phone after talking to a despairing woman after hearing from a doctor and said, "Sheila, she needs you." And Sheila would eagerly walk beside her through every stage until recovery. I think too about the decision our church in Dallas made 8 years ago this fall when we decided to love all now. And all meant all, which is to say we decided that all of our members were equally entitled to opportunities to serve the Lord in our church regardless of sexual orientation or gender identity. And within a month, we suffered the loss of some 300 people in our congregation who had been dear friends and felt that they could no longer be part of our church. The pain of that loss to them and to us cannot be overstated. It was the hardest time I've known as a pastor. But the church did what it thought was best by saying that if God accepts us all as we are, we must do the same with one another. And it was not a decision to have no standards of right conduct. It was a decision to have standards that applied equally to all. But here's something curious that started to happen. Over time, we found that our church was becoming a magnet that was drawing all kinds of people that we didn't expect after that. Not just LGBTQ persons, but people who had been hurt by the church in all sorts of ways. People who'd been marginalized, people who'd left, people who didn't trust the church anymore. And they were coming. We welcomed more than 450 new members over the next 3 years and learned something about redeeming loss we would have never known otherwise. Sometimes loss creates space for new life. And gradually I too found myself focusing less on those who had left, much as I still love them, and more on those who had come, less on the loss and more on the gain. And all I could think of was Jesus saying that if I be lifted up, I will draw all people to myself. You just never know what God might do with you or through you. Your losses, both those you cause and those that just happen to you, may be just what God needs to bring great and unexpected gains to people everywhere and to God's own glory forever. Amen. So what to do? Well, we can pray, "Take my life and let it be," huh? And we can sing that. And if we feel stirred by the Spirit in some way to put our faith in Jesus Christ for the first time or for the 101st time and need to respond and come forward and make that public, we do that. And if God is moving in you to become a part of this church and to join the fellowship that is Second B, we invite you to come to be engaged.